Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Fast X, White Men Can't Jump, Prehistoric Planet Season 2, Muppets Mayhem, and a look back at The Little Mermaid from 1989. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Brazil. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news I want to talk about is the box office. Let's just look at it. It was an incredible hold for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. It dropped less than 50%, which that's significant, because generally the way a Marvel movie trajectory is, it's very front-loaded, especially once you got past the Avengers. The first weekend was very front-loaded, and they always had like a Thursday night preview, and it burned off a lot of that demand. So you would see these 60% or more drops in the second weekend, and that's kind of normal for Marvel movies. In fact, you haven't seen drops of less than 50%. I think maybe Black Panther, the first one, had a drop of less than 50%. But that was also an initial first superhero's origin story. The movies that dropped that little were stuff in Phase 1, stuff like Iron Man. The sequels and the Avengers movies tend to drop much faster, and the fact that Guardians of the Galaxy dropped so little, that shows that it certainly has staying power. This thing's going to stick around for a while. It's going to have a very strong May going into June, and that's a good thing, because for everybody who was out there yelling superhero fatigue, well, maybe not. Maybe it's that people just want to see good movies that have intriguing characters. And, you know, so comparing it to something like Quantumania, the Ant-Man movie. The Ant-Man movies were never huge hits. The Ant-Man movies never commanded massive audiences. This didn't have anyone really of any note outside of Ant-Man. So, yeah, it plays as an Ant-Man movie. Oh, yeah, sure, it's setting stuff up for the next movies. But the fact that this was not like, you know, like Doctor Strange and Thor Love and Thunder, those things crossed over a little bit, but Ant-Man was just Ant-Man and the Wasp. And of course, the Super Mario Brothers dwindled a little bit. It's down to like $12 million, but it's like pushing $550 million going into this weekend. And that's now on streaming. The Book Club, Next Chapter, did just a hair above $6.5 million. And to put that in perspective, that's about half of what the first movie did. And while I enjoyed Book Club, The Next Chapter, let's face it, it was not a necessary film. It was not something that people were clamoring. It was one of those very typical, we're doing a sequel because the first one did well. And then it, you know, goes Evil Dead Rise and Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Hypnotic came in number six with $2.4 million, which is catastrophic. Nobody cared about seeing that movie at all. I was going to talk a little bit about the writer strike, but I think this is something I think is more important and more interesting to talk about. Disney Plus announced, it was very late in the week, like on Thursday night, that it was going to be dropping shows and movies off of, well, and it's not just Disney Plus, but it's Disney Plus and Hulu. So those are kind of separate. Even though they're both essentially owned by Disney, Universal has a minority stake in Hulu. I don't think they've sold that off or given that back to Disney yet. So stuff coming off of Hulu isn't as alarming, simply because the streaming services, stuff comes and goes all the time. And a lot of that's rights issues. But it was weird because there were only a handful of movies that were coming off the two services. I think Turner and Hooch, the 80s film with Tom Hanks, is coming off. And, you know, that might be just like a rights issue. There might be a music rights thing that is thorny and causing a problem. Now, there are a couple big name stuff coming off of Disney Plus, including the one and only Ivan, which was made exclusively for Disney Plus. Well, I think it was supposed to come out in theaters, but in the pandemic, they pivoted it to Disney Plus. And I don't think they've ever done a DVD release of that. And The other one that I noticed was they're dropping the Willow TV series, which that's probably the biggest one. That's probably the most notable one. There's a bunch of smaller stuff, but to be fair, they're small. I would even call them fringe within the Disney Plus community, fringe properties. You know, like there's a documentary about Howard Ashman, and Howard Ashman was fantastic and wonderful, and I think he deserves recognition. But it's one of those things, when I saw that list, I said, well, these are probably just things that aren't getting watched much. And I don't know how the internal structure of Disney Plus works, but I imagine the stuff that's not watched much isn't a priority to keep on the service. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there going, they're doing it so they don't have to pay residuals, those cheap SOBs. Well, it's one or two things. It can't be both at the same time. You can't be paying writers and talent so poorly with streaming that there's no money in it for the talent and the creatives, and at the same time have it be too expensive to pay out the residuals. I don't think those two can exist in the same universe. Now, Warner Brothers purposely took a lot of stuff off of HBO Max, and a lot of that was for residuals, and so they didn't have to pay creators and that sort of thing. But I don't know if that's why it's going on Disney Plus. Looking at the list, it's a bunch of things people aren't watching. And I can't believe people are getting so upset about it, because it's like, Disney's not obligated to put its entire library on there. And they're not pulling the Pixar stuff or the Marvel stuff or the Star Wars stuff. Streaming is changing. And so the business model is changing. And one of the things they might start doing is saying, let's try and license this to another company to broadcast. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Martin Scorsese's new film, which is from Paramount and Apple TV Plus, and that is Killers of the Flower Moon, which is in theaters on October 6th.
The Osage took their name from Missouri and Osage Rivers. Niukanska, children of the middle waters. Move, said the great white father. There are many, so many hungry wolves.
Look, I love Martin Scorsese. I think his stuff is visionary and brilliant, and I mean, it's long and drawn out. I'm looking forward to this one, but it looks like a very heavy, dark and weighty drama, which you expect to get from Martin Scorsese, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. You don't get a whole lot of idea of the plot aside from the fact that it's a clash between Native Americans and white businessmen. I'm looking forward to a good deal, and it's going to be in theaters exclusively in October, and then it's going to show up on Apple TV Plus. It probably just depends on how much money it makes in the theaters. The next one I want to talk about really quickly is Theater Camp, which is coming to theaters on July 14th.
Welcome, auditioners.
You guys are so talented, so unbelievable. This will break you. This will fully destroy you.
Congratulations on being the most talented kids at camp.
These people are really weird.
Sad news, I will not be doing piercings anymore in the hut because there's a narc amongst us. Cassie has narked. It's totally fine.
We only have 3 weeks to create a masterpiece. It's on you now. All on you.
This is supposedly, I think it's like kind of like a mockumentary type style. The buzz I'm hearing is it reminds a lot of people of Waiting for Guffman, if you have ever seen that movie with that Christopher Guest did back in, I think it was either the late 80s, early 90s. But it's about a theater camp with these kids there and sort of these extreme personalities. And look, I have been involved in theater when I was in high school. I did my fair share of theater. I had two of my sons were heavily involved in theater. And this looks like it hits a lot of these targets that you have on there. It looks like it's going to be very funny and enlightening. I'm looking forward to it. I think this is going to be kind of fun. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be looking at Muppets Mayhem and The Little Mermaid. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews and start on Disney Plus, called Muppets Mayhem. The Muppets House Band, Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem finally commit to producing an album under the tutelage of a wannabe music executive.
These guys go hard!
Well, we got a little sidetracked by the 80s.
For sure.
1, 2, 3, 4!
I'm Nora Singh from Waxtown Records. I would love to help you make an album.
Well, all right.
Nora?
What's happening?
I think Animal digs you.
I dig the animal as well.
I've been waiting my entire life for an Electric Mayhem album. Finally, somebody is making it happen.
Okay, it begins.
The Muppets used to be very, very edgy. Even you can go back to the stuff from the 70s, The Muppet Show. The first season of The Muppet Show is almost subversive at times. And it's really interesting to watch now. And of course, it became then popular with kids, obviously. And it became much more of a family thing. And so they kind of, even before Disney got a hold of it, they took away some of the more controversial or edgy and subversive elements, especially when it came to Dr. Teeth and Electric Mayhem. I mean, if you watch the first season of The Muppet Show, there's a whole arc in there where Floyd Pepper, the leader, well, Dr. Teeth is the leader, but Floyd's kind of like the spokesperson for the Electric Mayhem. He was like, they were striking, or, I mean, it was, they were an edgy kind of element to it, and it was much more in line with, you know, the sarcastic comedy that was put out in the 70s. And yeah, there's a certain sanitizing of characters when it comes to the Muppets, but I do love the fact that they sneak that stuff in there. If you remember, they had that primetime television series a couple years ago with the Muppets, which was kind of like an Office version. It was like sort of like a mockumentary version of The Muppet Show. And that had some pretty edgy stuff and some pretty, some adult humor kind of stuck in there. And that's kind of what I like about the Muppets Mayhem. The story is the Mayhem has been playing all its years, and they just kind of float like, you know, a feather on the breeze with their lives. They don't get tied down to anything, and they're all just like, whatever, man, we're just gonna do whatever we want to. And it's very funny because it's very much, it parodies the way a lot of bands act. Oh, the big difference is that they're still together, whereas most bands end up breaking up. But they toured so much, they just never cut an album. And so this one record producer, or this one, well, she works at a low level in this record company. And then she realizes that they have a contract for Electric Mayhem to cut an album. So she wants to cut the first Electric Mayhem album. And I think that that's a nice little launching pad. It has certain Disney Channel elements to it. It has Taj Mohri, who is from, well, his sisters were the twins. I forget their names. They're in Twitches and Twitches 2. And Sister Sister was a TV show they were on. He's her younger brother. I mean, of course, he's like in his 30s now. And he was also on the TV series Baby Daddy. So he's not exactly Scream's family friendly, but he does have that family show background to him, I guess. And it's not great, but it's funny because generally in most of the Muppet bits that have Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem, they're just an agent of chaos. They just cause problems and are weird or strange. You know, Animal is obviously the most extreme example, but all of them are like that. And they're able to make a story about them. And it is funny. I mean, it is a little bit Disney Plus-ish. It's not as edgy as The Muppets. If this were made in the 70s, as a TV series, it would have been a lot edgier. You know, I mean, it would have been really pushing the PG label at that time. But this one, I mean, but they like make jokes, like they make a joke about Meet the Feebles in there. And I'm like, are you kidding me? How, what kid has seen Meet the Feebles? Who, what kid should have seen Meet the Feebles? Which is a Muppet story that Peter Jackson did, but it's R-rated, very R-rated. So, I mean, it's silly. It's not something that I really want to binge watch. I think there's 10 episodes. I'm several episodes in. It's not something I want to watch hours of, but it's nice to just throw it on there for a half hour diversion every now and then. I mean, it still has that Disney veneer of the modern Muppets, but there's enough clever items that the parents are going to get, making it kind of a fun series. I'm going to say Muppets Mayhem kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Little Mermaid. No, not the new one. I'm talking about the original one from 1989. This is the old traditional cell animation from 1989. This animated Disney classic tells the tale of a love-struck mermaid who trades her voice for legs to meet a prince.
Up where they walk, up where they run, up where they stay all day in the sun.
It's the story of Ariel, a beautiful young mermaid who wants to become human.
He's very handsome, isn't he?
I don't know. He looks kind of hairy and slobbery to me.
Not that one. The other one.
And she'll strike a bargain with a powerful sea witch.
Have we got a deal?
To make her dream come true.
What I want from you is...
your voice.
My voice?
You've got it, sweet cake.
Ariel's been turned into a human.
Whenever there's a big remake movie out there from Disney, like I did this with Aladdin, I did this with Beauty and the Beast, I like to go back and watch the original animated film, because one of my beefs about both Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast is watching those movies, all it made me want to do is go back and watch the original animated film. So it's nice to go back and revisit. It gives you a nice basis of comparison. And so with the remake coming out next week, it gave me a chance to check out the original animated version of The Little Mermaid. And it's so funny because I don't think of it as being that old of a movie, but I mean, it was. It came out. I was still in high school when this thing came out. I grew up when the Disney products were kind of on the downslope, you know, in the 70s. You know, yeah, stuff like Robin Hood. But you know, by the time you got to like Fox and the Hound, it was really sort of stumbling a bit. And they were still trying to find their footing. And I even remember there was a movie, Oliver and Company, that came out in the mid to late 80s, right before Little Mermaid, where they almost had their groove back, but they were still struggling in the animated feature department. And it was when they brought out the Little Mermaid, everything clicked again. And then that led to Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and the Lion King. And that was a four movie run that is a juggernaut in Disney history. It revitalized the animation department, and the music was so wonderful. I mean, Alan Menken was good, but Howard Ashman was the key, just with his lyrics were so perfect. And it's such a charming movie. It's funny going back and watching it. It's very simply animated. It's not a complex animated film. But, you know, it runs really short. It's very breezy, and it's like less than 90 minutes. I went and saw it in high school, and I loved it. And it was the first time I loved every single song that was in a Disney movie. Because usually there's always that one boring song. You know, like Cinderella has bippity-boppity-boo and that good stuff. But it also had that stupid thing she sings when she's washing the floor. So this was one that the slow songs, the fast songs, everything was great. And I lost my mind during Les Poissons. I thought that was the funniest scene I'd ever seen. So this triggered all these emotions. And what I remember, I was watching it not as a kid, but as a teenager, but recognizing how Disney product made me feel as a kid. And I'm having flashbacks to that. This is such a good movie and precisely done and great cast. I absolutely love this movie. It's efficient and charming. This beautiful animated classic was responsible for breathing new life into the studio in the 80s, and I couldn't be more happier with it. And it holds up so well 30-some years later. So I'm going to have to say Little Mermaid from 1989 totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Fast X and Prehistoric Planet 2.
Les poissons, how I love les poissons! Love to chop and to serve little fish!
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the driver's seat and talk about Fast X
and family.
A forgotten villain from the past targets Dominic Toretto and his family to seek revenge, and a lot of crazy nonsense happens.
Dominic Toretto, you're about to learn all about fear. You built such a beautiful life, filled with love and family.
I never got that chance.
You stole that from me. My future. My family. And now, I'm gonna break yours.
First of all, I have to just admit, I'm not a huge Fast and Furious fan. Pretty much the first four movies are garbage, in my opinion. They're mildly watchable to me. And the people who say Tokyo Drift's the best one, you guys are insane. Okay, sure, the action's cool and the racing sequences are cool, but Tokyo Drift's a terrible movie. And Too Fast, Too Furious is not far behind. They're both crap. The first movie's okay. The fourth movie is overly long. It's not until they get to Fast Five and they become this bizarre street racing James Bond type movies. But the movie, there's still consistent problems with all the movies. They're usually bloated and way too long, and they've gotten now to the point. The cast is absurd. Every movie, they pick up more people. It's like an Ice Age franchise. What started out with just a handful of folks, you know, and now it's, you know, dozens of people in these movies. And the stories are terrible. The writing is garbage. The dialogue is awful. And it just gets stupider and stupider as the thing goes on. Now, that with all that said, they're entertaining movies. And they certainly are spectacle. And one of the things I've been saying for months is as theater-going habits change, post-pandemic, post-streaming. And this started, by the way, almost 15 years ago when Avatar came out, or before Avatar came out, the first one. People are going to see spectacle. The point being is TVs at home are good enough that if you want to see Are There Gods Me, Margaret, it's marginally the same at home as it is in a theater. But, you know, a big movie with car chases and explosions, that's the kind of thing you're going to want to see on the big screen. That's why Top Gun Maverick, I think, did so well last year. When it comes to the action, yes, it's cool. It gives you exactly what you want from a Fast and Furious movie. Incredible action and the explosions and the car chases and the crazy stunts. Although now it's sort of like Furious 7, where it's leaning so far into the CGI stunts that it's less impressive. There are some of them that actually have some really impressive scenes because they're using real cars on the road. But, you know, like when they're taking over a submarine or sending cars into space, that kind of thing. Well, you all know that's CGI. But they have a lot of the this is very heavily leaning into the CGI action. So those purists who want to see real cars crashing, you get some of that, but you also don't in this movie. These movies are exhausting. They're too long to begin with. Everyone treats these movies, all the people involved treat this movie like it's Shakespeare. If Shakespeare were writing sonnets about V8 engines and family. If you look at how Vin Diesel acts in this and everybody acts, they're so serious. They are taking, and I guess that's kind of what kept this franchise going, is the people involved take it very seriously. It's absurd that they do because it's stupid stories. These are international action scenes that make no sense. I've heard people say this and they're absolutely right. The writing in this movie feels like it's done by AI. As much as everybody's talking about AI writing scripts, after the writer's strike or during the writer's strike. And that's one of the reasons they're striking, aside from residuals. This is what you'd get with an AI script. It just adds random crap in there and it kind of fits together and it kind of follows a trajectory, but it doesn't make any sense. And the dialogue's awful, but everybody takes it super serious except for Jason Momoa, who plays the bad guy. And I know he's getting a lot of praise for it. And look, there's things I do appreciate it about. I love the fact that he's got the Fat Thor dad bod. It's seriously, it's like Jason Momoa was approached and he's like, yeah, I'll do the movie, but I'm not working out. I'm going to be eating Little Debbie snack cakes on the set because he's a little bit chunky in this one. Good for him. You know, I also love the fact that he plays around with, like, he's very effeminate. He's like his metrosexual in this. And on the one hand, I appreciate it because I think it's one of the things I'll bet you it's one of the things he talked about. He's like, look, I'm tired of just always playing these males dripping in testosterone. Can I play something off type a little bit? And so he's got painted nails and he's very flamboyant. Although at times they're like, he's comfortable enough with his sexuality, but like in one scene, he blows a kiss at a woman and then gives a raspberry to a guy. And I'm like, it's almost like they're going, yeah, but nobody's not gay. I don't know. It seems to be trying to do it and then just like pulls away at the wrong time. But, you know, gosh, this movie is so long that, you know, after about an hour and a half of it, I'm just getting tired of his shtick. Because he just doesn't take it seriously. And while it's fun and it's ridiculous, it doesn't make for a good villain. He's a cartoon. And there's other weird things that bother me. Like, there's a whole chase sequence with Dominic's sons in the passenger side, and he's the one launching cannons at the bad guy's cars. And he's, like, literally blowing up cars. The son in this movie has a higher body count than many of the adults. Is that good? I mean, yeah, I know he's running for his life, and these people are chasing him. But even if you're killing bad guys, you should have a certain level of worry about that. So, I mean, there's weird stuff in this movie, but it's by far the most ridiculous installment in the Fast and Furious franchise. And remember, they drove a car into space in the last one. It's trying to be The Empire Strikes Back. It's trying to be Infinity War. And it misses the mark in a lot of ways, but the spectacle's there. There's car chases, and a lot of things get blowed up. Anyways, I'm going to be nice because it delivers on what it promises, a big, stupid, dumb, explosive movie. So on that, I'll say it kind of rocks, but I mean, it's not a good film.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Prehistoric Planet 2. Apple TV Plus presents another season of dinosaur study through the lens of a modern nature series.
66 million years ago, planet Earth was ruled by dinosaurs, both majestic and extraordinary. The mysteries of their lives have been largely undiscovered. Until now. Explore five new worlds filled with danger and adventure.
If you haven't watched the first season of Prehistoric Planet and you have Apple TV Plus, check it out. Basically what it's done by the people who do BBC Earth. And they even get David Attenborough to narrate them. And he is like the guy who narrates nature documentaries. You watch almost anything from BBC Earth and David Attenborough somewhere around it. And what they do is they shoot plates and they shoot nature, and then they've digitally added dinosaurs into it. You know, like you're doing a nature documentary on elephants or wildebeest or something like that. It's a great shtick because you feel like, and the CGI is so good because it makes you feel like it's real. You feel like you're really watching these dinosaurs in the wild and you're just sort of catching them in these candid moments. You know, the camera's kind of behind bushes sometimes and it's not always the perfect shot. And it's just done with real well done artistry to make it feel like it's a BBC Earth thing that they literally sent cameras back 65 million years. And, you know, you got more dinosaurs, more. I mean, it's very similar to the first season. Second season is, I think it's six episodes and they're each about 45 minutes. It sticks to that shtick. It commits to the idea that this is a BBC Earth real film documentary. You feel like you're just watching lions on the Serengeti, only they happen to be dinosaurs. So yeah, this is beautifully done, beautifully shot, beautifully animated, fully committed to this setup. The wildlife documentary style is a brilliant, immersive look into the lives and species of dinosaurs millions of years ago. Prehistoric Planet 2 totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about White Men Can't Jump and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Brazil. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about a new film, which is on Hulu, and that is White Men Can't Jump. It's not the one from 1992. It's a remake. A failed basketball star teams up with a shill to help swindle money from other teams on the neighborhood courts.
It's really hard to plan for the future when we're always worried about money because you're out here living in a fantasy.
It's almost the first.
I'm gonna go tomorrow. I forgot.
Why don't you just go now?
It'll be fine. Hey, don't worry, Mommy.
Don't worry, Mommy.
Every hooper I know is entering that big tournament with a winner get $500,000.
I just need somebody who can play so I can make some money.
Yeah, you're right.
We can hustle a few games together to get the money for the entry fee.
I'll find some marks.
Those short shorts look incredible on you.
Throw them off their game.
You have an OnlyFans?
And we'll clean up.
I'm going to first off just admit I've never seen the original movie. I never even saw the first Space Jam in the theater. I watched it on VHS just because I was curious. That's the closest I'm going to get to watching a basketball movie. Certainly not 1992. I wasn't going to watch a basketball movie. It didn't interest me at all. So I can't compare it. I know it's a beloved classic, the original White Man Can't Jump, but it apparently follows about the same story. And there's a lot to be said for a movie that doesn't have somebody like Wesley Snipes and Woody Harrelson. You got to remember, back in 1992, Wesley Snipes was being groomed as the next huge action star. Wesley Snipes was meant to follow in the footsteps of Stallone and Schwarzenegger. And he never did. He sort of stumbled once he finally got to the end of the 90s. But he was doing a bunch of action-oriented films. And Woody Harrelson had done Cheers. He was best known for Cheers, but I think he had done a couple movies before that. He hadn't done like the big ones like Natural Born Killers, where he really differentiated himself into an edgier type of character. He was still coming off of the lovable, dim-witted character of Woody he played on Cheers. But this one does not have those stars in it. It doesn't have the star power. The first guy, the one guy who plays, because it's the same thing where the black guy and a white guy, and they go out to the courts and they swindle people because the white guy can really play basketball really well, and he's really good at sort of distracting people. The guy who plays the black guy, I don't even know. Off the top of my head, I could pull up IMDb notes, but I think it's more notable that he's not a movie star. And then the guy who plays the white guy, he's even less of a movie star, because I think he's a rapper and a YouTuber or something like that. You're anchoring this to kind of a TV actor, because I think that's what the black guy's from. But the white guy, you're just anchoring it to these terrible non-stars. And there's a reason they're not stars, because neither of them can carry this movie. The acting feels like at times overly improvised, by people just adding their own slang and that sort of stuff as they go on. And they're annoying characters, because the black guy, his character is, he had a lot of promise and he was going to go to college after high school, but he got in trouble with the law. That's why he's doing pickup games at the courts. And the white guy, he was a promising basketball player, but he tore his ACLs. And I mean, like, and they have stupid things about him. Like, well, he's a vegetarian. He's a vegan. Yet he's popping pain pills, and he's always trying to hustle. He's always got something going on, some side hustle. One of his side hustles is a cleanse that you drink. Now, look, I don't know if this has anything to do with the original movie, but this guy just seems like a complete moron. Yes, he's good at antagonizing people on the basketball court, and yes, he's got some promise as a basketball player, but it's unappealing characters. None of them, I don't like any of them. And honestly, I am struggling to remember what is going on in the movie, because the whole thing is they have to go to a basketball tournament because they got to win money. But it feels very trite and, poorly written. So, yeah, I there's a part of me that now wants to go back and watch the original and say, is the original is bad? But I don't think it is. This one just, it's bland and spiritless and dull, and this features characters that are irritating at best and unforgettable at worst. White Men Can't Jump. Can't jump. It sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I'm going to take a diversion, which I've been doing lately in the home cinema, and doing a spotlight on an older movie, and that is Brazil from 1985, directed by former Monty Python Terry Gilliam. And this is his follow-up to Time Bandits. I talked about Time Bandits a couple months ago. And ever since, I was like, I got to pull out my copy of Brazil and rewatch that, because it's a movie I like to revisit periodically. Anyways, Terry Gilliam directs this dystopian tale about a cog in government work trying to right a wrong and break out of his humdrum world.
Do you wake from your finest fantasy only to return to your daily nightmare?
Mr. Walker.
Is your mother about to look younger than you do? Does the woman of your dreams...
I love you. In my dreams, I love you.
...still have a few doubts? Then it's time to take a stand. To break out of your dull, humdrum life.
I remember when this came out, but I was too young to see it. And I don't think I would have understood it. I was about 14. But I remember it was a big deal because the studio re-edited it to be what Terry Gilliam refers to as a Love Conquers All ending. And they wouldn't allow him to release his version of the movie, which is darker and much more depressing, which falls in line in Terry Gilliam's stuff. Terry Gilliam, he's not a happy-go-lucky guy. And all of his movies have some sort of darkness, and they're absurd and silly and fun and hilarious, but they're also full of existential angst. It feels like it has this connective tissue a little bit with 1984, although 1984 is fully oppressed. Whereas this one, this is not even like a fascist government. It's just a bureaucracy on top of bureaucracy on top of bureaucracy. And the people in the government who are there to keep the bureaucracy going. And in the process, some people get processed, we'll say, to use that word again. There's something about this that is both fantasy, because part of it is this one character, the main character played by Jonathan Irving. He has these fantasies because he works in just this public works office, and it's very depressing, and he's literally a cog in the wheel. And he has these fantasies, high fantasies of flying and being sort of almost a superhero. And he has this dream girl. And when he finds somebody who looks like her, she's not at all like the dream girl is. She's, you know, she's got a chip on her shoulder and she's a little bit violent and problematic. And she might be involved in terrorist bombings and that sort of thing. But it hits several things, especially to somebody in the middle of their life. If you talk about somebody middle-aged, which is why I don't think I would have caught this if I were 14 when this first came out. But it hits the button of the realization that your life is meaningless. And a lot of times people are working a job, and they're just working the job to get enough money to pay the bills so they can wake up and work the job again. And that's what he's doing. But he doesn't really do anything significant. He's just there to perpetuate the bureaucracy. And there's, he needs an escape. And so in that escape, he has this high fantasy world where it's not quite superhero, but it's sort of on that level where he's literally flying above the city and he has to fight these big, these big bosses basically. And anybody who's in their 40s, or 30s, or in anything beyond that, should be able to relate to that, to sit there and be like, look at what I could have been doing, or how I could have escaped all the time wasted in my life. And it's about regrets, and it's about living up to your potential, and living up to what other people think your potential is, because there's a side story where his mother is trying to meddle with his job, and it's about the dangers of being oppressed and how you can break out of that. And not even if it's in a realistic terms. I mean, this can be just an allegory for your own life. And there's a lot of depth to Brazil. It's a brilliantly done movie. It's Gilliam's best at complex science fiction, featuring a perfect mix of existential depression and absurd humor. You see the Monty Python side, but it doesn't feel like a Monty Python movie. And that's where I think he peaked. And he did some other stuff after that, you know, stuff like 12 Monkeys and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and Fisher King. You know, he did stuff after this. But this, I think, is really, this is peak Terry Gilliam. I'm going to have to say Brazil totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
And that's it for the show. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Little Mermaid, the actual new remake. And with that, I need to go. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.